Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning, and welcome to The Show on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, a surprise conference switch for Grand Canyon University. We'll talk to GCU's VP of Athletics about that change. And Colorado Democrats propose a way forward for the party. But first, President Trump is no stranger to merchandising. Over the course of his political career, he's launched a line of Trump-branded Bibles, sneakers, meme coins, and perhaps most famously, the ubiquitous red and white MAGA ball caps. His latest product is fragrances. A couple weeks ago, he released Trump Victory 4547, a line of colognes and perfumes for men and women. This actually is not Trump's first foray into the world of scent. Back in December, he released a collection called Fight, Fight, Fight to commemorate the attempt to assassinate him while he was on the campaign trail last summer. We wanted to get a perfume expert's perspective on Trump's new fragrance. So we called up Saskia Wilson Brown, the founder and executive director of the Institute for Art and Olfaction and the host of the radio show Perfume on the Radio.
In terms of a precedent for a sitting president releasing a perfume, I don't know of any. But I guess any comparable would be sort of the celebrity perfume culture that is definitely not a new thing and has been around for, you know, a decade or actually longer than that. Like when Paris Hilton released her perfume or Kim Kardashian, that's the culture I feel that this compares to.
And when folks like that come out with a fragrance, do they tend to work with somebody to really develop something that feels unique and new, or is it usually a situation where they're just kind of putting their name on something that already exists?
Most of these celebrity fragrances are done through licensing deals where an agency, a company, in Trump's case, it's a company called CIC Ventures, basically licensed the name.
Well, Victory 47 for men promises rich masculine notes with a refined finish. That's a quote, but does not list any of the ingredients or the scent profile. I don't know if you've actually smelled Victory 47 for men, but if we look at ways other fragrances have tried to evoke things like wealth and masculinity, what would some of the ways of achieving that effect be?
It's a good question. And, you know, of course, gender is evolving. Our perception of gender is evolving, and particularly in perfumery. But, you know, traditionally, by which I mean the 20th century, European style perfume, you know, you would be looking at notes like a fougère. And I will say that the Trump's male perfume, Victory, you know, 4547 for men, does list on Fragrantica, which is a fragrance website, does list that it has a fougère accord. And so that's sort of a green mossy smell. It's very recognizable as a sort of classic men's cologne smell. On Fragrantica, they also list notes like geranium, cardamom, and amberwood, and then woody notes. So, you know, it's a little bit, geranium surprised me a little bit because that is, and cardamom did as well. But for the rest, it's pretty predictably masculine, you know.
Well, since it sounds like you've also looked at that website, Fragrantica, you probably also saw the ratings of Trump's scent. Tell us about those.
You know, Fragrantica has, you know, been accused of cleaning up the comment section, which I imagine, you know, if you're running a website like that and you're dealing with Trump, you probably have to a degree. So the ratings are there's very few. And, you know, mostly they didn't get into the politics. They got into the perfume itself. And they weren't terrible, but they weren't amazing. They were kind of a big resounding whatever. I have to tell you, I haven't smelt these. They're rather expensive. And then, you know, I didn't want to pay that money. So I didn't buy them. Well, so I'm just going on hearsay. You know?
Sure. But that is the other thing I wanted to ask you about. The price of these fragrances is nearly $250 a bottle. In the market more broadly, where does that situate these fragrances?
It's sort of the luxury niche market. So that cost isn't so abnormal, to be honest, in the perfume space. What is, you know, not common is the combination of how it looks and what it's saying, and then the cost. Usually things at that cost level are very perfumer forward and they're very fragrance formulation forward. So they'll go to great measure to explain why the cost is high, because they're using very special cardamom imported from wherever, you know. Mm-hmm. What's different here is that there's very little interest in explaining the actual formulation. It's more about the person himself. Mm-hmm.
But so am I understanding correctly that ordinarily something that's around $250 a bottle, it would be the kind of thing that people who take fragrances very seriously would think, oh, it's the latest release by this person whose name is a known quantity in this world, and it would be very exciting to think about them coming out with some sort of new fragrance where the design of it would really seem to warrant the cost.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's basically predicated on artisanship. You know, the idea that these perfumers are artisans, and they are artisans. They're quite good at what they do. So that artisanship is what people are paying for.
Have you seen the bottles for this fragrance? What does it look like?
Only on the internet. Yeah. So, you know, from what I see, it's like a sort of round bottle that's very shiny. And then at the top, you know, I'd say 2/3 of the total object is this sculpture of Trump, you know, in gold. Mm-hmm. Now on the internet, word on the street is that the bottles look quite a bit less wonderful than they do on the website. Apparently they look quite cheap and plastic. Mm-hmm. To me, they seem frankly quite generic. So.
How would you situate this fragrance launch in the broader context of the fragrance scene of the moment? My understanding is that sales have slowed a little bit in the midst of the tariff-related economic uncertainty.
Yeah. Anecdotally, you know, during and after COVID, perfume was having a moment. Certainly what I'm hearing from my friends and colleagues in the space is that the tariffs have really thrown things off. Some European perfumers are also intentionally not distributing in the U.S. as an act of protest. You know, others are. So I don't know. I don't know how to place it, because it's a classic celebrity launch, perfume launch, but it's also our president. So, and typically celebrity perfumes aren't that expensive, but because it's Donald Trump, of course, it has this illusion of value, which is his stock and trade. So it's overpriced, you know, for what it is in terms of what's usually sold on the market. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying it's not worth it. I'm sure to some people it's worth it, but it, in terms of its competition, it's overpriced for its sector. So it doesn't fit in with the industry. It doesn't make any sense, but people will love it, I'm sure. And I'm sure it'll sell wonderfully for the people who love him.
If you were going to design a fragrance to smell like victory, what would you do? Where would you start?
Tough question. It would probably be a little bit bombastic. Wealth is another question that's kind of interesting, because, you know, there's this idea that wealth is meant to be showy, but actually, you know, my experience of, which is limited, I'm afraid, but my experience of real wealth is that actually it tends to present a little bit more understated than one would expect.
Right.
So
right.
It's the sort of illusion of wealth versus real wealth. And for me, real wealth is a subtle, understated thing that informs everything else, but that doesn't necessarily need to trumpet itself. So to that end, I would design it in a more subtle way. I would probably use some amber materials, like ambergris type materials, mm-hmm. maybe some gentle woods, you know, some rich and opulent materials like oud, or even, you know, narcissus or things like that. But it wouldn't be a classic fougère, you know, because it's too generic to be victorious or wealthy. You know, it's just generic.
Well, that is Saskia Wilson-Brown, the founder and executive director of the Institute for Art and Olfaction and the host of the Perfume on the Radio show. Saskia, thank you so much.
Thank you, Sam. Thanks for having me. It's always a delight.
Protesters gathered outside a recent Tempe City Council meeting, and dozens spoke inside to try to stop an ordinance they call a violation of free speech and assembly. But the council approved the measure unanimously anyway. It all has to do with changes to special events permits, and it all goes back to an ongoing controversy over events to feed the homeless in Tempe City parks. My co-host Lauren Gilger spoke with Arizona Republic First Amendment reporting fellow Taylor Seeley more about it.
Begin for us, Taylor, with just a little bit about what this ordinance actually says. What's in it?
So this is an ordinance that Tempe has passed to basically better create a permitting system for any public events that happen on city property. So thinking about the public parks here. And what it says is that any public events with more than 30 people need to go through the government to apply for a permit and await government approval. It also creates provisions where it says events that may have adverse impacts require certain city resources, such as police officers or traffic staff. Events like that are going to need government permission before they can move forward.
Okay, so that sounds relatively innocuous and probably similar to what many other cities have on the books, but this has become very controversial in Tempe. Dozens of people speaking out against it. There was a protest before the city council voted on this amendment. Tell us why. What are the concerns?
Sure. So you're right that this is not abnormal for cities to have permitting processes for events on public property. The controversy here really began a while back when groups in Tempe called mutual aid groups were starting to feed homeless individuals in parks. And they had frankly done this for about 5 years. It began around 2020. One of the advocates who did it, Austin Davis, actually was rewarded by the city, named something like Neighborhood Event of the Year for these free picnics for the homeless individuals. But eventually what you started to see was that large crowds of homeless individuals were upsetting nearby neighbors. The neighbors were claiming that the homeless individuals were littering, that they were leaving behind drug needles or tin foils, and some even say that they were leaving behind human waste. Mm-hmm. Residents that I spoke to were incredibly upset, saying that they were regularly cleaning out waste or drug paraphernalia in their front yards or their back alleys. And so you see the city start to clamp down and say, hey, your events are getting big. You're going to need a permit for that. And the advocates said, wait a second here. We've been doing this for years. You used to reward us for doing this. Why all of a sudden the change in enforcement? And what the city says is, well, technically you've always needed a permit,
right?
But we kind of let it slide. But now they're getting so big, we really need to crack down on it. That's where the controversy began.
And it's gotten so much more controversial since then. And I'll have you give us a little bit more of that history, because there have been lawsuits related to this. This controversy about the homeless events in particular isn't technically mentioned in this ordinance, but folks definitely say that's what it's aimed at.
Correct, because what you saw was essentially the residents saying, wait a second, why would you one day say that we're not subjected to this ordinance, and then the next day say we are? And so the residents actually got together and sued the city in court, saying that this was a violation of their First Amendment rights. They're saying that their picnics are actually freedom of assembly, their freedom of speech, it's their advocacy, and they're actually protesting the city's inadequate response to homelessness, is what they say. Mm-hmm. So technically before that lawsuit, the city, though, did begin revising their ordinance. And that's what you saw on July 1st. The city council passed a new revised set of rules that clarifies that this is any event above 30 people. And again, events with adverse impacts or that require city resources. So trying to sort of clarify that we're not targeting you. This is really everyone. It's about the effects. It's not about the substance of what you're doing, but rather the effect it has on the community.
Right. So I asked you about what the folks who are upset about this had to say. What about the people on the other side? Like, this was a unanimous vote for this ordinance from the city council. What did council members, what do other people have to say about this on the other side of it?
People who are supportive of the permit point to what the city is saying, which is that we're not directly targeting events on homeless people. We're targeting the effects that it has on a community. It's interesting. Some residents think that perhaps the advocates have some constitutional rights here to advocacy, to charitable giving. But other residents say, hold up, those rights stop when they start to infringe on my safety and security. So you have a real debate here over, whose rights prevail when free expression and charity is pitted against public safety concerns. And I think you see the council say, We need to balance everyone's interests. And I think they don't believe that these permits will stop the picnics from happening. Although the city staff, has been very careful to say, this would probably qualify under a lower impact permit under the revised rules. You probably pay around $25 to go ahead with these events, but they really can't say officially until they get that application in. And some of the picnic organizers have in the past said, well, historically, you've required us to get really expensive insurance for every event that we have. And that makes it such a costly burden for us that it is going to shut us down. So it's going to be interesting to see how it actually plays out.
Right. So there are some sort of First Amendment concerns that are being brought up here. This is becoming a First Amendment conversation.
Absolutely. And the First Amendment scholars that I spoke with, they all acknowledge modest permits are normal, even for protesting. I think that's something that often people don't realize. A lot of protests have to get permits before they can move forward. But when your protest isn't clear, pure speech, and it's sort of that gray area where, you're feeding the homeless, is that a message? Is that not? What is your message? That's when it becomes more expressive conduct. And so the city's ability to say, well, we want to regulate this because the conduct is having an effect, they get more flexibility in that area. So again, it'll be interesting to see how that court case plays out because how will the judge view feeding the homeless? Pure speech, more in line with pure speech, or more in line with conduct that is subject to regulations?
All right, so a lot still up in the air to watch for. That is Taylor Seeley, First Amendment reporting fellow for the Arizona Republic, joining us to talk more about this story out of Tempe. Taylor, thank you for coming on. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, table tennis playing robots might, someday soon, help aging adults with daily household chores. We will hear how from a professor at ASU's Interactive Robotics Laboratory. But first, Grand Canyon University jolted the world of college sports this week, announcing that it would be joining the Mountain West Conference much earlier than it had previously planned. The move follows a series of other significant changes to the school's sports programs. To help us understand, I am joined now by GCU's Vice President of Athletics, Jamie Boggs. VP Boggs, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me here.
Thank you for being here. So GCU was planning to join the Mountain West Conference in 2026. Why move up the timeline?
Well, we were invited to a different conference and decided to decline that invitation, and we needed a place to play this year. And considering that we are moving into the Mountain West, we're planned to in 2026. We thought with the great universities that are the members of the conference, why not try to get in a little bit earlier? And very fortunate that Commissioner Navarez and the member institutions gave us that opportunity.
Why decline the other invitation?
Well, the opportunity for the Mountain West was one we just could not turn down. It's just the Mountain West has a very strong is very strong in multiple sports, and pretty much top 10 in most of the sports that we compete in from a conference standpoint out of 30 conferences. And the brands and the name brands of the institutions in the conference were just an opportunity we couldn't turn down. It also set us up from a financial perspective where we could really grow our brand, and there was an opportunity for exposure as well with the TV contracts that were available in the Mountain West.
So you mentioned that it's a competitive conference. There are schools like Boise State, San Diego State, Colorado State, Fresno State in the conference currently. But as I know you know, a lot of the teams in that conference are leaving next year for the Pac-12. So what do you make of the future of the conference and GCU's competitive place in that?
Well, the vision of the conference and the footprint of the conference and the competition there are still extremely strong. And, we're very data-driven as a university. We run the numbers and we know what strength of schedules and the RPIs and of all the universities. And we love that what is staying in the Mountain West, it's a very strong conference. Definitely a significant step up from where we were, although we really appreciate our time and opportunities that we were given in the Western Athletic Conference. But Even with the schools that are departing, I mean, the New Mexico fan base is just incredible. We have an incredible fan base, so the opportunity to bring those schools together and have a great game day environment. They have great facilities, great fan bases, so we're really excited about the future of the Mountain West.
Can you talk a little bit about the practical implications of a change like this? Because, you know, people might see the headlines and just think, oh, okay, they're kind of moving from one column into another one. What does it actually mean, you know, from the lived experience of a student athlete in terms of travel schedules? I guess competitive environment would be part of it, types of fans you're going to be encountering out on the road. How do you think about that part of it?
It impacts pretty much every area. You think about just from a recruiting standpoint and how your team roster looks. It's a different style of play for several sports. It's different altitude. Climate's different.
Right. Yeah, sure.
And also you can get a kind of another even level. And we are, I want to reiterate, we have outstanding student athletes right now, but it does bring another level of competition that attracts a different type of student athlete. So from a recruiting strategy, from scheduling strategy, because the Mountain West, there's several at-large opportunities in multiple sports. And so you have to think about how your non-conference schedule looks and how do you ensure you have an at-large opportunity throughout the, you know, and not just have to win the NCAA tournament. From a marketing standpoint, an attendance standpoint, and in-game standpoint, there are very passionate fan bases and they travel really well. So how do we ensure that our game day we still get that home court advantage with our fan base? And I, you know, with the Havocs, our very passionate student section, I don't worry about it, but sure. I know they're really excited about bringing up another level.
Let me ask you, you know, speaking of some of the changes that have been happening in college sports, the House settlement was approved and went into effect about a week ago, and GCU opted into paying student athletes as a result of that settlement. Does that decision factor into this conference change decision at all?
You know, it's just the changing landscape. And yes, we did opt in for the opportunity to give direct name, image, and likeness opportunities for the student athletes. And it's really just the landscape of college athletics right now. I don't think it's you really can't be competitive in this space without providing those opportunities for student athletes. And you know, the thing that we're trying to do is make sure that the opportunities that are given really still align with our mission as a Christian, really service-oriented university. So we're very thankful for the businesses and donors who are supportive of our student athletes and giving them NIL opportunities. At the same time, we know that the heart of who we are is a university that serves the community. So we try to do opportunities where our student athletes can serve at schools and serve at hospitals and have a community aspect to it. And that's how we are navigating this NIL space.
Just about 30 seconds left, VP Boggs. What, if anything, have you heard, I know this change just happened, from student athletes about this decision?
There is a tremendous amount of excitement to be a part of the Mountain West. Our coaches were telling us yesterday, there was an air of excitement and a renewed level of passion to continue to our trajectory of winning championships. We won 76 championships in the WAC and intend to do the same in the Mountain West.
Okay. Well, good luck this upcoming season. And that is Jamie Boggs, the VP of Athletics at Grand Canyon University. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
A group of Democrats gathered in Denver earlier this year to talk about a possible path forward for the party. They were touting what's come to be known as the Colorado Way, which Democrats have been using for more than a decade to turn this once reliably Republican Western state blue. Natalie Fertig, a state's reporter at Politico, was in Denver and wrote about it. My co-host Mark Brody spoke with her about her reporting. They started with what exactly the Colorado Way is.
Yeah, so it's a combination of politics and policy. It's both selling issues from an economic standpoint, so based on how they impact people's pocketbooks, rather than something more philosophical like care for the environment or care for lower income families. And then also marrying that with a political structure. In Colorado, they started at the bottom. They went for state house, you know, just getting one chamber and then two chambers before they started focusing on Senate races and on the presidential race. And then three, actually, I should add, is also the funding. They had a couple really wealthy donors that committed to putting money into just turning Colorado blue, not focusing on specific Democratic issues, but turning it blue so that then Democrats collectively could put their issues forward.
So was it more about sort of changing the political tone of the state almost and less about the individual issues that got the candidates there?
Yeah. So one thing that was really interesting is that candidates focus their issues based on their district. I know this sounds obvious, but I think a lot of times messaging can overtake from a state level or from a national level to where every candidate is saying kind of the same thing. And in Colorado, they really just let candidates be their district. So that ended up running the gamut in within the Democratic Party. There were some things they didn't negotiate on. You know, they weren't backing Republicans who claimed to be a Democrat, for example. But, you know, if it was a Democrat, as someone described to me, if there was D by their name, we were backing them.
Well, and that kind of goes to, it seems like, one of the problems that Democrats are trying to face right now, which is, you know, there are all these conversations about purity tests, or if this person is left enough or too center or maybe even too conservative to really be a Democrat. Sounds like what you're saying is in Colorado, that really didn't matter. As long as they identified as a Democrat, it seems like the people behind this effort didn't really care necessarily what they thought about particular issues.
Yeah, I think that that is really, you know, there's maybe a little bit of space in there where there were some issues like gay marriage, for example, that sure, they probably would not have supported someone who didn't back that idea. But yeah, ultimately, the small incremental differences between people on things like education policy or environmental policy and the way to frame it was left up to the candidates. I was talking to Senator John Hickenlooper from Colorado about this, and he said that there were, in the West, there were more barn raisings than shootouts. And sort of that idea of, in the Democratic Party at the time when the state was turning, they really tried to not turn the guns on each other. They tried to instead come together to lift the barn of the Democratic Party up. And then, as another operative told me, you know, once you have power, then you can execute power. But in order to put forth your policies, you have to win first.
Right. Well, so in what ways do folks who buy into this Colorado way think that this might be the way forward for Democrats, either in individual states or maybe nationally?
Yeah. So part of, I think, the big question is going to be how to nationalize this. A lot of this works by starting at the state level and then moving up. Actually, one of the things I found out when reporting this is that former Arizona governor Janet Napolitano actually went to Colorado during this era to try to learn some of what the folks in Colorado were doing and bring it back to Arizona. So a lot of the conversation is still, how do we flip states? How do we flip state legislatures and then build that up into flipping, you know, a state for the presidency or for Congress in a way that will actually change the entire national dynamics of Republican versus Democrat? I think also something, though, that is a big hurdle right now for everyone in the Democratic Party as they're trying to figure out the path forward is just the lack of a leader. You know, the Republican Party has President Trump, and the Democratic Party doesn't really have a leader. So you have people, some of whom fit this model, like Colorado Governor Jared Polis, some other governors like Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer, who are in that sort of more pragmatic, let's find the economic angle to this issue that is a Democratic issue. But then you also have folks on the left, you have Bernie Sanders, you have AOC, who come at the economic conversation from a more populist approach. And you haven't really found one person as the figurehead to lead the full party that way. So right now it's more happening at the state level of, hey, Colorado's doing this. This is the Colorado way. Does Arizona want to do it? Does, you know, New Mexico want to do it? Does Nevada want to do it?
Well, does it seem as though this is transferable from one state to another? I mean, you mentioned Janet Napolitano. She, of course, was very successful here. She won a race as attorney general. She ran. She won two terms as Arizona governor. Does it seem as though this technique could be used in a place like Arizona?
I think every state has its own dynamics, so it's not going to be the type of thing where one size fits all. But that was something I was asking a lot of the folks when I was in Denver for this retreat is, how are you nationalizing this? And I did talk to quite a few people. You know, Will Marshall is the was the organizer of the event. He had worked in the group that had actually, you know, ended up sort of supporting Bill Clinton in the 90s, and the last time the Democratic Party was in a similar place to this. And he told me that, you know, he's from rural Virginia, and he said that he thinks that a lot of the approaches in Colorado will also speak to voters like the people he grew up with in rural Virginia, because there is sort of a pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Let's focus on the economics. Let's tailor a messaging strategy to the district, to the state, rather than doing something that's one size fits all at the national level. So, you know, it seems from what these organizers have said that they do see a path forward where this can be implemented both on the district level, on the state level, and then also on the national level. But I think, you know, the proof will be in the pudding on that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, did you get a sense from some of the Democrats with whom you spoke at this event how optimistic they are that not only can this Colorado way be exported to other states, but that it can be successful either on the state level or eventually maybe on the national level?
I mean, they were very optimistic. You know, some of these folks have done this before with Clinton in the 90s. So they sort of have a winning record on their side, so to speak. I also think that they're in the camp of Democrats that wants to be optimistic about the future and wants to see a path forward, which I think is kind of, you have to take, no offense to them, but you have to take that with a grain of salt, right? Is that Democrats want to be optimistic right now about their chances. I think, though, that you have to, something I kept asking them is, you know, libertarianism is a big part of Colorado, the Colorado way. It's something that everyone was talking about. Does libertarianism translate to rural Pennsylvania? That's not actually something that I know the answer to, honestly. And I think that that is what these strategists are going to have to figure out over the next 2 years and then, you know, 3.5, 4 years.
All right. That is Natalie Fertig, a states reporter with Politico. Natalie, thanks a lot. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. Now we revisit a story that I did earlier this year about a Valley resident with a very interesting occupation. Dan Meyer arrives at the studio with a long, narrow black bag. As we're getting settled, he takes a moment to compliment one of our producers.
Kirsten, by the way. Sorry.
Hi, Kirsten. Oh, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too. Kind of me.
That's an awesome sweater.
Oh, thank you. I got it for Halloween.
Kirsten's sweater has a picture of a skeleton's ribs on it.
I need to get one of those. It shows where everything goes.
Right. There you go. Dan Meyer is a sword swallower. He was a top 50 finisher on America's Got Talent, and he's in the Guinness Book of World Records.
Ask anything you want. Okay. I've probably been asked it a few times before.
He's in his 60s, thin and stylishly dressed, with dancing eyes and a perpetual grin. Before we get underway, Dan takes a moment to run a brush through his mop of blonde hair.
The first 20 years of my life, I grew up in extreme fear. I would shake and stutter. I couldn't talk very well.
Because of this, Dan says, he got bullied a lot. Kids would call him names and beat him up.
So I vowed, as a little kid, I wanted to do things the bullies could not do. I wanted to do real magic, do real feats. I wanted to be like a superhero and fly around the world doing superhuman feats and saving lives.
When Dan was 20, he was living in India as a Lutheran missionary. It was 115 degrees during the day. So at night, when the temperature dropped, he and his friend Greg would sit on the roof of the bungalow where they were staying. And one night, Greg asked Dan a question.
He said, "Do you have thromes, Daniel?" I said, "Thromes? What are thromes?" With an M.
Uh-huh.
And he said, "Thromes come from a book called The Thromes of Errol of Sherrill."
According to Dan, thromes are major life goals.
Like, if you could go any place you want to go, do anything you want to do, be anyone you want to be, where would you go? What would you do? Who would you be?
That night, Dan lay on the roof, looking up at the stars, trying to make a list of thromes. Eventually, he drifted off to sleep.
And I woke up a few hours later, and my whole body was shaking and trembling. And this time, it wasn't with social anxiety disorder like it had as a kid. Come to find out, I had 105-degree malaria fever.
Dan says he was in and out of consciousness for 5 days, fighting for his life. And while it was a tiny mosquito carrying an even tinier parasite that had made him sick, Dan decided that his real problem was an emotional parasite.
And in a moment of clarity, I realized that fear was my kryptonite that had crippled and paralyzed me my entire life.
Dan beat malaria, and the night his fever broke, he made his list of thrones.
I wanted to live on a deserted island, wanted to live on a ship on the ocean, wanted to live with a tribe of Indians, wanted to visit the seven wonders of the world, visit all the major continents, work with a circus, work in the music business in Nashville, climb to the top of the highest mountain in Sweden, see Mount Everest at sunrise, jump out of an airplane. I think there might have been a couple more in there.
Now, we don't have time to get into how it happened, but Dan actually did end up doing a lot of that stuff, including the circus part. In 1987, he moved to Nashville, and he started a group called the Music City Jugglers Club.
And we juggle every Tuesday night, had about 30, 35 of us passing clubs. And this van pulls up, and it had a bunch of sideshow performers in it. One of them was Tim Cridland, who goes by Zamora the Torture King. And the other one was George the Giant, George MacArthur from Bakersfield, California. He's 7'3", and he was a sword swallower.
George the Giant told Dan that there were only 12 living sword swallowers in the entire world. It's incredibly dangerous, George said. George personally knew of 29 people who had died doing it. He told Dan not to try it. Instead, Dan put sword swallowing on his list of thrones. He went out, bought a sword, and started practicing.
I'd practice 3 or 4 times in the morning, 3 or 4 times in the afternoon when I'd come home from work. I was working in the music industry. And before I went to bed, brush my teeth and practice 3 or 4 times. You know, I felt sick to my stomach every time I did it.
4 years, and by Dan's count, 14,000 attempts later, he still hadn't gotten the sword down his throat. He says he used to stare at diagrams of the esophagus on the wall at the doctor's office, trying to figure out what he was doing wrong. Finally, he went out and bought a copy of Gray's Anatomy.
And I found out what you have to do to get a sword down the throat is you have to go over into the oral cavity in the mouth, over the tongue, repress the gag reflex in the back of the throat, navigate a 90-degree turn down the upper esophagus through the cricopharyngeal upper esophageal sphincter, here right behind your Adam's apple, your voice box. Then you have to repress the peristalsis reflex, the 22 pairs of muscles that swallows the bolus of your food down into your stomach. Slide the blade down into the chest chamber, the thoracic chamber between the lungs. Nudge the heart aside to the left.
Nudge your heart to the left.
Occupational hazard, yeah. Piece of cake. Don't try it at home.
I certainly won't. Dan claims that when he swallows a sword, there's only an eighth of an inch of esophageal tissue separating it from his heart.
I'll have volunteers pull a sword out and they can feel the blade, you know, thumping on my heart.
Oh,
and I can
my
feel
God.
I can feel their hand shaking on my heart as well.
So oh my God.
It's really a profound feeling.
This is the point in our conversation where Dan reaches down, unzips the long black bag he brought along with him, and pulls out what looks like a pirate sword.
This is a single-edged cutlass. This one I got here in Mesa at a sword shop.
Dan says when he walked into the shop, he told the guy behind the counter that he swallowed swords. If he could swallow that cutlass, Dan asked, would the guy give it to him for free? The guy said it was a pretty expensive sword, but if Dan could prove he was really a sword swallower, maybe he'd give him a discount. So Dan took the sword off the wall, ran his tongue along the blade to moisten it, and slid it down his throat.
And about that time, I felt it start to burn.
Okay.
And I thought, uh-oh, I think I punctured something. It was burning really bad. My throat started to swell up. I went home and drank as much ice water as I could, as many vitamins, took Theraflu and everything I could to knock myself out and see if I could sleep for 12 hours that night. I sat up in bed spitting blood into a bucket for like 3 days.
Oh, my God.
And I almost died from that one. And then I did what any normal red-blooded sword swallower would do, is I went back and I
bought that sucker, and I'm going to swell it for you right here.
Oh, my God. Okay. Well, so this is the sword that caused that, and it is going down Dan's throat. It's about halfway down, and now it is all the way down. He's got his arms outstretched, and now he is making a sawing motion as he pulls it out and appears to be completely unharmed.
That's it.
I don't know if you've ever watched somebody swallow a sword, but I'm here to tell you, even if you have just received a detailed explanation of how it works, it's a little hard to believe it's actually happening. But what seems obvious is that Dan has never doubted his ability to do it. It was a throme, and Dan has a vow to uphold. These days, Dan is working on a new throme, and it's even more high stakes. In 2022, he went in for a colonoscopy, and the doctors found 6 cancerous tumors.
I rubbed my hands together and I said, oh good, this is going to be great. This is another challenge to beat.
Speaking of hard to believe.
For the past 2.5 years, I've been no chemotherapy, no radiation. I've been taking about 100 supplements a day. We've shrunk down 5 of the tumors. I've got 1 left.
Well, wait, can I just ask, the supplements that you're taking, is that what you attribute the shrinking of the tumors to?
Quite a bit of it, yeah. It's
what supplements are they?
Turmeric, or ivermectin, fembendazole, just a bunch of different things that are known to shrink cancer or fight cancer or starve cancer.
And did you do this? Was this a situation where the doctors recommended chemo and you decided to do this instead?
Exactly. A little doctor from South India said, oh, we need you to come in tomorrow morning. We're going to put a hole into your heart, a port into your heart. We're going to start you on chemo for 16 weeks. And I'm like, I can't do that. He said, why not? I said, well, I'm going to do Alaska State Fair and Eastern Idaho State Fair, and then Sweden's Got Talent. And I can't do that. I can't be sick to my stomach and losing my hair. I've got gigs to do.
I should note here that the New York Times recently reported a surge in misinformation about ivermectin. To quote from the Times piece, there is no rigorous research showing the drug cures cancer in humans. But Dan has always been someone who trusts his own experience, ever since that night on the roof when his friend Greg asked him if he had any thromes. If he hadn't asked you that question that night, who do you think you would be today?
I would probably still be in fear.
Dan Meyer is a sword swallower. His book, To the Hilt, A Sword Swallower's History of Sword Swallowing, is now available in podcast form. It's called To the Hilt. You're listening to the show. Good morning and welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. What is the relationship between playing ping pong and doing household tasks? For our next guest, the answer is found in a robot. Henny Benamor is an associate professor at ASU, where he works on robotics and machine learning. He and a team with Google DeepMind have been building and training a robot that plays table tennis. But the goal is not to rule the basement or the rec room. The goal is to help people with chores around the house, especially people who can't do some of those tasks on their own. Benamor spoke more about this with my co-host Mark Brody, and they started with how exactly this project is working.
Absolutely. So this is a project together with Google DeepMind, and one of the big milestones in AI has been sort of something that was called the AlphaGo moment. A couple of years ago, Google was able to beat the world champion in the Chinese game of Go, and that was considered really sort of a major milestone in AI. However, all of that was sort of virtual. None of that was happening, or no one was actually moving the chess pieces, you could say. And so what we wanted to do is to have a similar moment for robotics, meaning that you have robots that learn and engage and have maybe human-level capabilities, but all of that is happening in the real world. They're actually moving the chess pieces. But in our case, it's not chess pieces, it's table tennis.
Well, and playing table tennis is a lot more sort of quick movements than chess. So what kinds of challenges does that pose for you and your team who are trying to do this?
There's a variety of challenges, but actually in our case, we were really looking forward to these challenges in order to tackle them and then see sort of how we can fill this knowledge gap. So one of the challenges is that in table tennis, if you're just watching the ball, by the time you actually get to the ball, it's too late. What human players do, at least good players, is to anticipate where the ball is going and already be ready to kind of hit the ball back in the right way. Now, another challenge here is that the ball is, you know, since it's very fast, it's actually not easy dexterity-wise to hit it with the paddle the right way in order to get it back on the table. And even more challenging is to hit it, for example, with a spin or make sure that the ball lands at a particular location on the table. So all of that requires really complex physical skills and dynamic reactions. But these reactions are more than just reactions. They're really an anticipation of the future and then acting on what's going to happen rather than what's happening right now. And it also involves incorporating both perception challenges. So we need to see the ball and anticipate where the ball is going. But we also need to reflect on what the best response is, what the robot should be doing. So quite a number of challenges. And if you make even a tiny mistake, well, the ball is going to go somewhere else.
So obviously, like, the main point of this project you're doing is not to, like, create a world champion table tennis player. The goal is to ultimately be able to use robots like this to help folks to live independently, to help with, you know, sort of tasks around the house. I'm curious, what is the relationship between teaching a robot how to play ping pong and helping them with some of those other tasks?
It's this aspect of human-robot interaction. Ultimately, what we would like to have is robots that engage with humans in a meaningful and safe way. And so for that, we need to have a way to measure whether robots are actually engaging and whether they are reacting to a human player at all. And table tennis is kind of a really interesting benchmark because you can very quickly figure out whether the robot is responding the right way to a human or anticipating the human's actions the right way. Now, the same technology can be used to help people at home, meaning we would like to have robots that anticipate your needs, for example, at home, and according to that, then plan their actions so that they can help you at the right time. Now, one of the things that probably you're aware of is that we don't have robots at home. And one of the challenges for that is really that they have a hard time coping with sort of all of the changes and the dynamic aspect of our home. So robots need to take their surroundings into account, both the inanimate surroundings, you know, Lego pieces on the floor, a book or a moved chair, as well as humans and the sort of actual family inside the home.
So is the goal then to, for example, if the robot was going to be in the home, to not have to have somebody program or, you know, quote unquote, ask the robot, okay, hey, can you change this light bulb? Can you set the table? Can you sweep up, you know, this mess? But to have the robot kind of somehow know that those things needed to be done without being told?
It's a combination of both, actually. On one hand, we would like the robot to understand your instructions, to execute those instructions. But potentially, even if they fail at that, they could self-improve and adapt and learn. So machine learning is really a critical part of what we've been working on. And so that's one part of it. And then the other part is actually having robots that can create something like a capability model of the human partner. So the robots start to understand what the sort of weaknesses and capabilities of my human partner are, and they can then incorporate that into their actions. And so that leads automatically into some sort of anticipation, anticipating what the human partner needs, what their weaknesses are, and then based on that, sort of engaging in a meaningful and safe interaction.
I have to say that listening to you describe that, I'm reminded of the TV show The Jetsons, who, of course, had, you know, Rosie the robot sort of doing all the housework. It kind of sounds like that's the direction you're heading in here.
This is great that you bring this up. Right now, I have a follow-up project that I'm working on. And the title of this project is actually Rosie the Robot, which is the name of the robot in The Jetsons TV show. And kind of in our case, we say ROSI for robot self-improvement. So indeed, what we'd like to have is robots that can engage in interactions with humans, but at the same time, they need to be able to perform physical tasks. Right now, many of us are using ChatGPT, right, and Gemini and all of these large language models. And that has led to sort of a hype around AI. But what we'd like to have is something like that, like these, you know, Gemini models and LLMs and so on, but that can actually execute something in the real world. You ask them to prepare breakfast, and the robot goes out and prepares breakfast. Maybe the robot already knows what your preferences are. Maybe they know, for example, if someone is diabetic, not to include sugar and so on. So this actually has sort of a meaningful purpose behind that. And in my specific case at ASU, I'm using similar, if not the same algorithms, to create a prosthesis, a lower leg prosthesis for people with amputations. What we would like to have is to have these robotic technologies that assist them, but can also learn a profile of their user. And they know that you have a certain walking gait, that certain a certain walking gait leads, for example, to pressure on your body, and they try to avoid that. So this technology really has sort of a much deeper underpinning. And what we're trying to do is to fill this knowledge gap by starting with table tennis, because there it's very easy to assign a number and say whether we're making progress or not. And then that knowledge, that body of knowledge that we then create, we use it for a variety of different tasks that have a much deeper sort of societal value.
All right. That is Henny Benamor, an associate professor at ASU, where he works on robotics and machine learning. Henny, thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Much appreciated.
Well, we hope this Wednesday edition of the show nudged your heart, figuratively speaking, of course. May you complete all your chores and your thrones, and we hope you'll join us again tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. For Mark Brody and Lauren Gilger, I'm Sam Dingman. We'll talk to you then.
That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.